Okay, let's pray together. Father, we're so grateful for the opportunity to study the great works of God in the history of the church, particularly as you began to unfold the wonderful riches of the deposit of truth given us in the scriptures of especially the New Testament canon, and as we continue to study how those things impacted and molded and in some ways were distorted by the minds of the apostolic fathers this evening, we ask that you would use this study to cause us to enter more and more clearly into the teaching of your word. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, it's my day and my week to study eschatology. We come to Roman numeral 2 here on talking about the doctrinal significance of the apostolic fathers. And I spent all day reading Jim Hamilton's commentary on the book of Revelation and then Ken Gentry's little introduction to the book of Revelation in preparation for that Revelation symposium I have to be at in Reno, Nevada on Saturday. And looking forward to doing that, but also have a lot to do yet before I can feel at ease about going, because there's a 55-minute talk and then a 20-minute talk that I have to give, and I don't say anything in public without notes in front of me, right? But anyway, we come to eschatology. Later I'm going to say that one of the great issues that has been a matter of controversy with regard to the apostolic fathers is the whole subject of their church government. And I say that's the major issue. But actually, I think approaching that issue, especially in our day, is the discussion of the whole subject of eschatology, especially in the second century, and especially the debate between premillennialism and amillennialism over who can claim the earliest church for their position. So we're going to talk about eschatology. And the first thing I want to say is that though there was clearly, as I'm going to point out, a difference of opinion among the early fathers on this subject, this conflict took place against the backdrop of a shared core belief about biblical prophecy. Here's what I'm talking about. I mean that the basic doctrines of the second coming of Christ, the eternal punishment, and the bodily resurrection are clearly upheld against all that would dispute them. About this issue, among Orthodox Christians, there simply was no dispute. Reinhold Seeberg says, there is a vivid sense of the vanity and perishable nature of this world and of the glory of the eternal world, as well as the terrible character of the torments of hell, especially in the apocalypse of Peter. The end of all things is thought to be very near. The chief thing remained the final judgment of the world and the certainty that the holy shall go to heaven to God and the unholy to hell. This was involved in the idea of reward for earthly conduct. In the very early work entitled The Martyrdom of Polycarp, which is not technically among the apostolic fathers, but certainly in the halo of them, Seeberg's comments are confirmed. In this writing, we hear sentiments about eternal punishment in hell, typical of the whole early church. And again, he said to him, I shall have you consumed with fire. This is what the Roman official is saying to Polycarp. If you despise the wild beast, unless you change your mind. But Polycarp said, the fire you threaten burns but an hour and is quenched after a little. For you do not know the fire of the coming judgment and the everlasting punishment that is laid up for the impious. But why do you delay? Come, do what you will. And as well, the subject of the bodily resurrection is a common agreement in terms of the doctrine of eschatology. Over against the Gnostic denial of the importance of the flesh, here's what Second Clement says. Remember, this is not really Second Clement, often known as pseudo-Second Clement. Still a very early writing and one of the apostolic fathers. Moreover, let none of you say that this flesh will not be judged to rise again. Consider this. In what state were you saved? In what state did you regain your sight, if it was not while you were in this flesh? Therefore, we should guard the flesh as God's temple. For just as you were called in the flesh, you will come in the flesh. That is to say, come in the resurrection. By the way, I suspect that when Paul talks about, he uses a similar language in 3 Thessalonians 4, he's talking about coming in the resurrection as well. But That's a different story. If Christ the Lord, who saved us, was made flesh, though he was at first spirit, and called us in this way, in the same way we too in this very flesh will receive our reward. So the whole subject of the resurrection of the body, the bodily return of Christ, eternal torment, these were not issues that were subject to dispute or debate among Orthodox Christians. But what was disputed is something that is very much contemporary in terms of its importance. And so let me come after that introduction to the identity of the question. The major discussion about eschatology regarding the early church among church historians involves premillennialism. This is one of those big words and technical terms that has emerged in the course of the great conversation about eschatology in the church. Premillennialism was refined and developed in a couple of major ways in the history of the church. Those refinements and developments come later in the conversation. In the early church, it's important to define this premillennialism in terms of its basic essentials. Premillennialism is essentially the belief that Christ will return prior to a thousand-year reign of Christ on earth that will take place before the final and eternal state is ushered in. Hence, the word premillennialism has reference to the time of Christ's return in relation to the millennium, the thousand-year reign of Christ spoken of in Revelation 20. And speaking of Revelation 20, let's turn to that passage. I hope you have your Bibles with you. Revelation chapter 20. I think you should have that text in front of you as we go through this. I'm not going to read it, but please have it in front of you. The following chart you see in your notes there attempts to make the basic features of premillennialism clear, and I think I don't need to say much more about that. Now, with regard to the premillennialism of the early church, extraordinary claims have been made. By way of introducing this question of the presentation of the conflict in the early church, it will be helpful to quote a statement that has been the source of not a little conflict in the modern church. Dr. Charles Feinberg has asserted the entire early church of the first three centuries was premillennial almost to a man. Now, if this statement were accurate, it would have great significance for us, I think we would all have to admit. It would create a strong presumption in favor of premillennialism. It's well known that Roman Catholics place a faith in the traditions of the early church and Protestants refuse to give those traditions. And Protestants are right to put their faith, not to put their faith in the traditions of the church. One does not have to be a Roman Catholic, however, to recognize that Feinberg's assertion, if it were accurate, would be very significant. And I've quoted to you last time, and it's quoted again in the notes here, the words of William Cunningham, the Scottish Presbyterian, who was no Roman Catholic, that says, even if we don't adopt any kind of Romish respect for tradition, still, if Feinberg were right, all of us would feel that that were really, really significant, wouldn't we? So we grant, therefore, that it's important to understand what the early church believed on this subject and that some weight should be attached in our minds to what they believe. Thus, it's necessary, having quoted Feinberg's statement, to say very emphatically that it is an extravagant overstatement and at best, a half-truth. That brings us to the nature of the question. It's difficult to understand how Feinberg has so plainly distorted the facts of early church history. Part of his problem may be, however, that he has assumed that prophetic views often associated with premillennialism infallibly prove that their authors were premillennialist. This is a logical fallacy. Here's what I mean. The question is not whether the apostolic fathers taught, in some sense, the doctrine of the imminent return of Christ. I think some people assume if you find a doctrine of the imminent return of Christ, since in our day, that's associated with premillennialism, not postmillennialism, that if there's the doctrine of the imminent return of Christ, the person who adopts that doctrine must be premillennial. But then, of course, the problem is that there are many amillennialists that believe in the imminent return of Christ, so that the doctrine of the imminent return of Christ is no clear sign that a person was premillennial. Another illustration of this is the doctrine of the Antichrist, a personal Antichrist. Again, Dr. Feinberg, for instance, may assume that if someone holds the doctrine of a personal Antichrist coming on the scene at the end of the age, that that means they're premillennial. But the problem is, of course, that many amillennialists hold the same doctrine. So that, again, the doctrine of a personal Antichrist is not a sine qua non or a necessary pointer to premillennialism. Now, the fact is that the apostolic fathers do speak, like the New Testament does, of the imminent return of Christ. They do, the apostolic, there are places where both in the Didache, chapter 16, and the Epistle of Barnabas, chapter 4 and 15, teach the doctrine of a personal Antichrist. But these things are no necessary indication that the authors or the adopters of those doctrines were premillennial. So that brings us to the examination of the question. The extravagance of Feinberg's statement will best be seen by an examination of premillennialism in the early church. This examination will consider its early emergence, its subsequent growth, and its final withering. First of all, the early emergence of premillennialism. Only two of the earliest or apostolic fathers may with any evidence be claimed for premillennialism. They are Papias and the person who wrote the so-called Epistle of Barnabas. The other writings are either indecisive or may even have some things in them that might point in a more amillennial direction. So the early emergence of premillennialism. Papias seems to have claimed to be a hearer of John the Apostle and a friend of the martyr Polycarp. He is said to have written five books in which he recorded statements of John and other early disciples. None of Papias' books survive. There are excerpts of them recorded, however, in their church history of Eusebius, written around 325. He lived from, Eusebius did, from 260 to 340. Eusebius intersperses his comments throughout his excerpts of Papias. He asserts that Eusebius, Eusebius asserts that Papias was a premillennialist. The actual excerpts from Papias that Eusebius gives us, however, do not explicitly state premillennialism. In my opinion, however, they do imply clearly enough that he was. Eusebius' comment about Papias is noteworthy. The same person, moreover, has set down other things as coming to him from unwritten tradition, amongst these some strange parables and instructions of the Savior, and some other things of a more fabulous nature. And, of course, the word fabulous here means having the nature of a fable, okay? Not wonderful, but mythical is really the idea. Amongst these, he says that there will be a millennium after the resurrection from the dead when the personal reign of Christ will be established on this earth. But we don't have any quotations from Papias that actually support that assertion of Eusebius, but I'm willing to grant it. Several aspects of this statement are interesting. Eusebius' statement makes clear that he was not impressed by Papias' claim that he got his stuff from the apostles. Indeed, all the reader has to do is read the excerpts from Papias and Eusebius' church history, and he will no doubt come to share Eusebius' opinion, and the footnote gives you where those are. Another interesting feature of Eusebius' comment is that it makes clear that he regarded Papias' premillennialism as fabulous, that is to say, mythical. It seems clear from this that Eusebius himself was not a premillennialist. No premillennialist would have described premillennialism as fabulous. This is our first indication that Feinberg's statement about the early church being premillennial to a man in his first three centuries is simply unwarranted. In the report that Papias was premillennial, Eusebius is plainly disagreeing with him. The Epistle of Barnabas was not written by the biblical Barnabas, as we have said. It probably dates from approximately the year 131. Even so, it's a valuable early Christian writing. Chapter 15 of the so-called Epistle of Barnabas is very important from several angles in the history of doctrine, including the subject of eschatology. The problem is, however, that it is complex to the point of being convoluted. See for yourself. Let me read it to you. And don't be prejudiced by me, but see if you don't think this is at least somewhat convoluted. Further, also it is written concerning the Sabbath and the Decalogue, which the Lord spoke face to face to Moses on Mount Sinai, and sanctify ye the Sabbath of the Lord with clean hands and a pure heart. It says in another place, if my sons keep the Sabbath, then I will cause my mercy to rest upon them. The Sabbath is mentioned at the beginning of creation thus, and God made in 6 days the works of his hands, and made an end of the seventh day and rested on it and sanctified it. Attend, my children, to the meaning of this expression. He finished in 6 days. This implies the Lord will finish all things in 6,000 years, for a day is with him 1,000 years, and he himself testifies, saying, behold, today will be as 1,000 years. Therefore, my children, in 6 days, that is in 6,000 years, all things will be finished, and he rested on the seventh day. This means, and of course, now you see, you know, you've heard, you know, history is so like a week of years, 6 days, 1,000 years per day. This is the first reference to that idea in the history of the church right here in front of you. Okay, interesting. But at any rate, let's go on. This means, he rested on the seventh day, means when his son coming again shall destroy the time of the wicked man, there's the reference to a personal antichrist, and judge the ungodly and change the sun and moon and the stars, then shall he truly rest on the seventh day. Moreover, he says, thou shalt sanctify it with pure hands and a pure heart. If therefore anyone can now sanctify the day which God hath sanctified, except he is pure in heart in all things, we are deceived. Behold, therefore, certainly then, one properly resting sanctifies it when we ourselves, having received the promise, wickedness no longer existing, and all things having been made new by the Lord, should be able to work righteousness. Then we shall be able to sanctify it, having been first sanctified ourselves. Further, he says to them, your new moons and your Sabbaths I cannot endure. Ye perceive how he speaks. Your present Sabbaths are not acceptable to me, but that is which I have made, namely this, when giving rest to all things, I shall make a beginning of the eighth day, that is the beginning of another world. Wherefore also we keep the eighth day with joyfulness, the day also on which Jesus rose again from the dead. And when he finished, when he had manifested himself, he ascended into the heavens. Now, do you agree that this is a highly complex passage? I grant that, superficially read, it has a premillennial ring. On the other hand, it makes no explicit reference to a thousand-year period on the seventh day. It speaks only of the destruction of the Antichrist, the judgment of the ungodly, and the rest of the Messiah on that day. And W.J. Greer actually aptly comments this way in his book, The Momentous Event. Barnabas' scheme of history was patterned on the week of creation in Genesis 1. The expression he finished in 6 days means, he says, that the Lord will finish all things in 6,000 years. The expression he rested on the seventh day contains the prophetic meaning that when Christ coming again shall destroy the time of the wicked man and judge the ungodly and change the sun, moon, and stars, then shall he truly rest on the seventh day. Premillenarians take the seventh day of the millennium. But what premillenarian is willing to admit that the millennium is ushered in by the judgment of the ungodly, as Barnabas states? According to the epistle of Barnabas, the seventh day will not come till, quote, wickedness is no longer existing, and all things have been made new. The eighth day is the beginning of another world. But all distinction seems to be done away between the seventh and eighth day when Barnabas says that the Lord, in giving rest to all things, which happens on the seventh day, makes the beginning of the eighth day, that is the beginning of another world. It is clear at any rate that Barnabas shuts out the possibility of an earthly millennium in which unregenerate men will be under the reign of Christ. It is perfectly clear, because then wickedness would still be existing, wouldn't it? It is perfectly clear, too, that he holds, as all others of his time, that the Christians and not Jews are heirs of the covenant. It is interesting to note that D.H. Krominger, a premillenarian, says the presumption is that, quote, Barnabas was what we nowadays call an amillennialist. That's in Krominger's book, Millennium in the Church. Greer's exposition of this difficult passage certainly makes an amillennial interpretation of it possible and perhaps necessary. But what is the meaning of this term, amillennialism? The word literally means that there is no millennium. Amillennialists do not, of course, deny that the Bible in Revelation 20 teaches a thousand-year reign of Christ. The point of this term is that they do not believe in a future 1,000-year reign of Christ after his return. They believe, rather, that this reign is a figurative reference to the present gospel age. The return of Christ results, then, not in a millennium, but in the final judgment and the eternal state. And you see the chart there. Now, again, I'm going to say, I've been listening to all this stuff online and listened to the conversation between John Piper, Sam Storms, Jim Hamilton, and who's the other guy? Doug Wilson. Online, I'd never done that before. That was very interesting to do. And I'm bringing it up because this whole subject about whether we amillennialists, and now I'm admitting that I am one, that we amillennialists really like that term amillennialist. Some amillennialists really don't like being called amillennialists because they think it's it implies that they don't believe in the thousand-year reign of Christ in Revelation 20, and they certainly do. They only interpret it figuratively of the present gospel age. So they don't like being called no millennialist, alpha privative, amillennialist, because they don't want to be implied that they don't believe in a millennium, a thousand-year reign of Christ, when they, in fact they do. It's in the Bible. They believe it. Okay? My reaction is not quite like that, because I think I've said this to you in your past, but words have both denotations and connotations. And I'm certainly, and I think we have to keep that in mind. The denotation of millennium is simply a thousand-year period, and in the Bible, the thousand-year period of the reign of Christ in Revelation 20, right? That's the denotation of it. The connotation of millennium, however, is something quite different. Millennium speaks of a great golden age of peace, righteousness, and prosperity on earth before the eternal state. That's what it connotes. That's what millennium connotes. Millennial is actually can be used of a golden age, okay? And in that sense, I'm perfectly willing to say that I'm no millennialist, because I don't believe in any such great golden age on earth before the eternal state. After the eternal state, I certainly believe that that's going to be a great golden age on earth, but it's going to last forever. Okay? So, and it's not going to be a millennial period, which is by definition a limited period of time, even though age long. So I don't mind being called an amillennialist, as long as it's the connotation of the word and not the denotation of the word that is in mind. Anyway, that was all free. If this plausible and amillennial interpretation of Barnabas is adopted or even entertained as possible, the only clear evidence for premillennialism in the early fathers is the highly questionable witness of Papias. All the other fathers are silent on the subject of premillennialism. Well, as I've done with regard to the doctrinal significance of the fathers with regard to other issues like the Lord's Day, which I dealt with last time, I think it's right just to spread out our viewpoint a little bit and to the rest of the second century. And here I'm going to then trace it out just briefly even farther than that. The subsequent growth of premillennialism. The above treatment of the early emergence of premillennialism has restricted itself to the earliest fathers of the church, those who lived before about AD 150. Again, however, the evidence from period of the apostolic fathers will be supplemented by evidence from the next period of early church history. The evidence for premillennialism among them is, as we have seen, scanty indeed. In the next period, however, what you might call the period of the apologist and the anagnostic fathers, there was an undeniable growth of premillennial teaching. Premillennialism enjoyed great popularity during the second through the fourth centuries of the Christian era. This becomes evident, first of all, in the writings of Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr, since his writings date from approximately 160, may be mentioned first here. He makes mention of his premillennialism in his dialogue with Trypho the Jew, chapters 76 to 81. It's very clear that Justin is a premillennialist. He says in chapter 80, "But I and others, who are right-minded Christians on all points, are assured that there will be a resurrection of the dead in 1,000 years in Jerusalem, which will then be built, adorned, and enlarged, as the prophets Ezekiel and Isaiah and others declare." This statement is a very clear testimony to Justin's premillennialism. The problem is that it also clearly testifies to something else. Justin makes clear that not all Christians agree with him about premillennialism. You see it? "I and others who are right-minded Christians on all points." This is clear in the above statement, but it's made explicit earlier in the same chapter. Trypho the Jew is cross-examining Justin about his belief that Jerusalem will be rebuilt as the center of a joyful fellowship of the Christ and his people during the millennium. "Is he really serious?" asks Trypho, "in affirming a doctrine held also by the Jews?" Justin replies, I am not so miserable a fellow, Trifo, as to say one thing and think another. I admit it to you formally that I and many others are of this opinion, and believe that such will take place, as you assuredly are aware. But, on the other hand, I signify to you that many who belong to the pure and pious faith, and are true Christians, think otherwise. So, in the earliest clear affirmation of premillennialism we have in the history of the church, in the very context of it, it's, the author of it makes clear that there are people who disagree with him who are true Christians. Who would they be, do you suppose? But I'm a millennialist, okay? In this amazing statement, we learn that even in the early church, people that Justin viewed as genuine Christians disagreed about the subject of premillennialism. So the debate goes back to the second century. And this means that there were true Christians in the second century who were not premillennialist, according to Justin. I think Justin's attitude is commendable and should have been imitated by many since his day. Premillennialism is not a test of orthodoxy, nor is it a mark of heresy. Too many premillennialists have said or strongly implied that anyone who was not a premillennialist was a heretic. This is wrong. And too many opponents of premillennialism have repaid the compliment, and this is also wrong. Certain other considerations should be kept in mind by modern premillennialists when they consider Justin's premillennialism. It is of a different kind than that commonly taught today. One of the great thrusts of Justin's dialogue with Trifo the Jew is the doctrine that Christians are the true Jews. To quote Greer again, Justin's millennium would have no special place at all for the Jew, for he tells us over and over that Christians are the true Israelite race. Modern premillennialists should also be aware of the fact that Justin's premillennialism is inconsistent. Greer ably brings out these inconsistencies in Justin's premillennialism. I think it's right to do this because it's not such an open and shut thing. When Justin Martyr is speaking of the kingdom for which Christians look, he denies that it is a human kingdom. You suppose we speak of a human kingdom, whereas we speak of that which is with God. Justin speaks of a general judgment at Christ's second coming, when death shall forever quit those who believe on him and be no more, when some are sent to be punished unceasingly into judgment and condemnation of fire, but others shall exist in freedom from suffering, from corruption and from grief, and in immortality. From these statements, one would suppose that there was no room for an earthly millennium in his teaching, yet inconsistently, he says elsewhere, that there will be a resurrection of the dead and 1,000 years in Jerusalem, which will then be built, adorned, and enlarged, and that thereafter the general and, in short, the eternal resurrection and judgment of all men would likewise take place. The famous church father of the late second century, Irenaeus, was also among the growing premillennial movement in this period. Schaff, the church historian, summarizes his views. Irenaeus, on the strength of tradition from St. John and his disciples, taught that after the destruction of the Roman Empire and the brief raging of the Antichrist, lasting 3.5 years, or 1,260 days, Christ will visibly appear, will bind Satan, will reign at the rebuilt city of Jerusalem with a little band of faithful confessors and the host of risen martyrs over the nations of the earth, and will celebrate the millennial Sabbath of preparation for the eternal glory of heaven. Then, after a temporary liberation of Satan, follows the final victory, the general resurrection, the judgment of the world, and the consummation of the new heavens and the new earth. Again, however, in the context of affirming his own premillennialism, just Irenaeus admits that there are Orthodox Christians who disagree with him. Here in his introduction to his defense of premillennialism are his own words regarding his opponents. But since certain of those reckoned to be orthodox overstepped the order of the promotion of the righteous and are ignorant of the method of the preparation for incorruption, they hold among themselves heretical opinions. Hill proceeds cogently and in detail to confirm that Irenaeus is referring to orthodox Christians who hold views which Irenaeus regards as similar to those of the Gnostic heretics. In a manner reminiscent of Justin, Irenaeus perceives opposition to his millennial views emanating from both orthodox and heretical circles. Tertullian was a respected leader of the Western Church in North Africa early in the 3rd century, but his zeal caused him to admire from a distance the Montanists. The Montanists were concentrated in the eastern part of the church. The Montanists were the charismatics of the early church. They believed in the continuation of prophecy after the apostles and also allowed women to hold office in the church. Sometimes Tertullian has been called a Montanist, but if this is true at all, it is true only in a highly qualified sense. Tertullian did, however, agree with the Montanist with respect to their premillennialism. Now, I have to say here, I'm not sure what's behind this, but there does seem to be an opinion that I've read or seen referred to in some modern church histories that actually asserts the Montanists were not premillennial. Now, I'm not quite sure what's up with that. I'm going to say it to be honest with you. Now, a number of the church historians that I've consulted make it very clear that they think Montanism was premillennial, and that was seemed to be a pretty widely held opinion. But there does seem to be some question about that. Well, whatever question there may be about the Montanist, however, there's no question about Tertullian, who claimed to be a Montanist, that he was premillennial. Says Schaff, Tertullian was an enthusiastic Kiliast, and pointed not only, Kiliast, by the way, is another word for premillennialist, okay? It's simply derived from the Greek word for thousand rather than the Latin word for thousand. And he pointed not only to the apocalypse, but also to the predictions of the Montanist prophets. But the Montanists substituted Papusa in Phrygia for Jerusalem as the center of Christ's reign and ran into fanatical excesses, which brought Kiliasm into discredit and resulted in his condemnation by several synods in Asia Minor. Now again, however, as Charles Hill shows, in his Regnum Caelorum, there is evidence in the context of Tertullian's assertion of premillennialism that orthodox opponents of his view existed. Montanism played a large part in the demise of early premillennialism. It is important, therefore, to go into a little detail about it. One authority gives this account of Montanist premillennialism, quoting here from the Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics. Not long after the beginning of the prophesying, Montanus crossed the Phrygian border and established himself with his followers in the city of Papusa. Papusa, with the neighboring village of Timion, he named Jerusalem. To this settlement, which was thenceforward the center and holy city of Eastern Montanism, he endeavored to gather adherents from all quarters. These facts, coupled with the lavish promises made by the prophets to their adherents and certain predictions of Maximilla, apart from a more explicit oracle attributed to another prophetess, would lead us to the conclusion that the new prophecy taught men to expect in the near future, at Papusa, the final parousia of the Lord. The primitive Montanists, in fact, held the doctrine of Kiliasm, but Kiliasm of a new kind. It was this hope of the parousia at their Jerusalem that gained for them the name of Papusians. It's not necessary to pursue the history of Eastern Montanism in detail. For some years after the death of Maximilla, the last of the original trio, in 179 to 80, there were no prophets, and the church and the world enjoyed peace, facts which, as anti-Montanistic writers pointed out, disproved the claims of the first prophets, because they claimed that when they died, the Lord was going to return, and he didn't. Schaff provides this concluding summary of other premillennialists in this period of church history. After Tertullian, and independently of Montanism, Kiliasm was taught by Commodian towards the close of the 3rd century, Lactantius and Victorinus of Patau at the beginning of the 4th. Its last distinguished advocates in the East were Methodius, the opponent of Origen, and Apollinaris of Laodicea in Syria. This evidence makes clear that premillennialism commanded a broad following in the early church. Premillennialists, as the example of Charles Feinberg shows, often bring forward this early premillennialism as a matter of weighty doctrinal significance in favor of premillennialism. As we have seen, the prevalence of premillennialism may be easily overstated. In at least four of the early references to premillennialism in the church, in Eusebius' citation of Papias, in Justin Martyr, in Irenaeus, and in Tertullian, it is made clear in the context that Orthodox Christians existed who were not premillennialist. Charles Hill presents broad and cogent evidence for a widespread amillennial interpretation of Revelation 20 in the anti-Nicene Church. Origen, for instance, is widely accounted to have been an amillennialist. But that sword has two edges, so we won't go there. Nevertheless, even when the evidence is properly weighed, it may appear difficult for the opponents of premillennialism to explain the presence and prominence of premillennialism in the early church. It may be asked, does not this evidence suggest that premillennialism originated within apostolic Christianity? Well, the answer to this question is no, not necessarily. There's another possibility, and that possibility is suggested by something we have seen already. As the quotations from Justin's dialogue with Trypho the Jew have already suggested, Justin realized that there was a strange kinship between premillennialism and Judaism. A Christian premillennialist could recognize a remarkable similarity between his own views and those of the Jews at this point. This fact tends to confirm the view that premillennialism originated within ancient Judaism. Masselink, in his work Attacking Premillennialism, asks this question. This is in his Why Thousand Years. What is the origin of this strange doctrine, you ask? The careful study of church history will furnish us with a conclusive answer. Premillennialism is a descent of ancient Judaism. There's a striking resemblance between the offspring and the parent. The old Jewish conceptions of an external messianic kingdom have found their perfect embodiment in the Chiliastic theory of the millennium. Premillennialism is a relic of Judaism. Now, as a matter of fact, when I was listening to Jim Hamilton and the dialogue with Sam Sorbs and Doug Wilson, he actually admits that in Jewish apocalyptic literature there was a difference of opinion. Now, in Jim's view, the book of Revelation and John the Apostle sides with those rabbis that were kind of the precursors of premillennial thinking. I think that's disputable, of course. But the fact is that in saying so, Dr. Hamilton admits that there are precursors for premillennialism in the Jewish rabbis and in Jewish literature. So within pre-Christian Judaism, there had grown up an eschatological system which placed the coming messianic kingdom prior to the eternal state, making them consecutive phases in God's plan for the end of history. That is to say, the messianic kingdom was thought to occur before the final judgment at the end of history and the eternal state. In 4 Ezra, for instance, the messianic kingdom lasts 400 years at the end of history. It seems plausible that early Christians coming out of a Jewish background could have imported this view into their new faith. They may not have realized that the present gospel age, now I'm speaking as an amillennialist here, I know it, but let me just say it. They may not have realized that the present gospel age was the messianic kingdom. So there was this early kind of futurist assumption about the meaning of a biblical prophecy in the book of Revelation that led them to say that this future literal millennial kingdom had to be placed somehow after this age, after the coming of Christ, and before the eternal state. Perhaps they were still influenced to some degree by the Jewish hope for an external kingdom before the eternal state. Thus, it would have been easy for them simply to tack on this system after the gospel age. This would have straightforwardly and directly produced Christian premillennialism. It is possible, therefore, that the origin of premillennialism is not apostolic, but Jewish. Now, what I don't say here, and what I don't deal with here, what Charles Hill deals with in great detail in his Regnum Caelorum, is all the evidence that there was an early amillennialism. And, of course, that evidence would beg the question, where did that come from? If you want to argue that early premillennialism must be apostolic, that must be its origin, then we have to ask the question, where did the early amillennialism come from? If there's an early amillennialism, Why can't we argue the same way and say that must be apostolic? You see the problem? This is a two-edged sword here. Well, that brings us to number three, the ultimate withering of premillennialism. The growth of premillennialism did not continue. At the height of its popularity, it seems to have gone into a rapid decline. Two major influences appear to have brought about the complete demise of premillennialism: the excesses of Montanism and the verdict of Augustine. The peculiar form of premillennialism held by the Montanists has already been noted. Their extremes had the marked tendency to bring disrepute upon premillennialism in the early church and certainly contributed to its gradual demise. When several church councils in Asia Minor decreed against Montanism, this could not help but have a negative effect on their favorite doctrine of premillennialism. By the way, there were some parts of the early church that were so anti-Montanist that it raised questions over the very canonicity of the revelation of John. And where the revelation of John was rejected because of the assumption that the Montanists were right in teaching from it premillennialism, and there was such a emphatic rejection of premillennialism that they questioned the canonicity of the book of Revelation because of it. Another evidence for early amillennialism. At any rate, so when several church councils in Asia Minor decreed against Montanism, that had a negative effect on the doctrine of premillennialism. And as well, there was no greater theological authority for the Middle Ages than Augustine of Hippo. When Augustine rejected premillennialism, the eschatological course of the next 1,000 years was set, and anti-premillennialism would be the position of the vast majority of Christian theologians. Augustine's key pronouncements against premillennialism occur in the City of God, Book 20, Chapters 6 to 10. In Chapter 7, Augustine, having just described premillennialism, gives this assessment of it. And this opinion would not be objectionable if it were believed that the joys of the saints in that Sabbath shall be spiritual and consequent on the presence of God. For I myself, too, once held this opinion. Yes, Augustine says he was once a premillennialist. But as they assert that those who rise again shall enjoy the leisure of immoderate carnal banquets furnished with an amount of meat and drink such as not only to shock the feeling of the temperate, but even to surpass the measure of credulity itself, such assertions can be believed only by the carnal. They who do believe them are called by the spiritual Kiliast, which we may literally reproduce by the name millenarians. It were a tedious process to refute these opinions point by point. We prefer to show how that passage of Scripture should be understood. And the passage to which he refers is Revelation 20. And at this point, Augustine proceeds to give what we would call an amillennial interpretation of Revelation 20. Included toward the end of this exposition are clear indications that Augustine believed in a personal Antichrist who comes on the scene, in the final little season before Christ's return after the 1,000 years are completed. These chapters of Augustine are fascinating in the light that they shed on the withering of premillennialism in the early church. We see the process itself going on and the fact that Augustine admits that once he himself had held and then rejected premillennialism. We see something of the reason for Augustine's distaste for premillennialism. He sees it as encouraging a carnal hope for the future. Augustine's subsequent exposition makes clear an adequate alternative interpretation of Revelation 20. And then you can see that I have a chart there on the growth and then withering of premillennialism in the early church, and with some of the major names that are associated with this. One last thing is just to make another comment about a tentative explanation for the popularity of premillennialism. I think it's at least arguable that the same theological soil which produced a growing legalism produced a growing premillennialism or Kiliasm. Now, I've already shown you the evidence for the legalistic, moralistic kind of viewpoint that was getting started in the Apostolic Fathers. I do not mean to say, of course, that premillennialists are legalists. I only mean to say that in both legalism and chiliasm, there is a receding of the already in favor of the not yet. The receding of the already and increasing prominence of the not yet had two ramifications. It's possible in that this receding of the already in the favor of the not yet provided ground fertile for the growth of premillennialism. Now, let me explain what I mean. The emphasis on the truth of grace, on the fact of grace, on the importance of grace, is bound up with the already in the New Testament, Revelation 5, 9, and 10. The emphasis on the need for effort and perseverance is bound up with the not yet, Hebrews 4, 11, Hebrews 3, 6, 14, Matthew 5, 27, 13, and 14. In other words, when you talk about, well, let me just use the doctrine of justification. When the New Testament talks about justification as something that is present, accomplished fact for Christians, it talks about how free it is, how it's all by grace, right? Being justified, therefore, by grace. But when other places in the New Testament, say Matthew 12:37 or James 2, talks about the doctrine of justification as present or future tense, the emphasis is on works. And so all I'm saying is that I think what one of the things that gave rise to a growing trend towards legalism was the receding of the not yet, the receding of the already in favor of the not yet. And when you have the receding of the already in favor of the not yet, you have more and more emphasis placed on the need for perseverance and effort and works in order to be justified at the day of judgment, and a receding of emphasis on grace because grace is resident in the already aspects of the New Testament. Now, I'm saying that same trend of the receding of the already in favor of the not yet also could lead to a neglect of the fact that the kingdom has come. And again, you have this tension in the New Testament. The kingdom has come, the kingdom is going to come. The kingdom is present, the kingdom is future. Now, if you begin to have a receding of the already, the idea of the kingdom already coming, and an increasing emphasis on the fact that the kingdom is yet future, that makes a futurist interpretation of the book of Revelation, and therefore of Revelation 20, very easy, almost natural, to fall into. So it's easy then to apply passages which speak of the kingdom solely to the future. Take 1 Corinthians 15, 21 and following, for instance. Just as the emphasis on the not yet leads to a focus on our persevering effort, which can be easily distorted into legalism, so it also leads to a focus on the future kingdom, which can be easily distorted into chiliasm. One should also mention that there is a clear externalistic tendency in both the chiliasm and the legalism of the early fathers. All right, that's as far as I'm going to go with this lecture. I do have a postscript and excursus on the fact that of whether Augustine should be classed as an amillennialist or a postmillennialist, but that gets pretty far afield from early church history. And so I'll let you read that for yourselves. That concludes the first lecture. Next lecture will come to the doctrines of the sovereignty of grace and the deity of Christ in the Apostolic Fathers. All right. You have any questions? Yes, Andrew.
Yeah, does the term chiliasm include postmillennialism as well?
Oh, that's a great question, Andrew. I believe I have seen it used of postmillennialism. But I think the connotation of chiliasm is, and here I can't prove this. This is just a sense I have from the reading I've done in eschatological works, okay? I think chiliasm carries with it also the sense that the millennial period is ushered in by some sort of catastrophic or cataclysmic event. I believe that's true. So normally, for premillennialists, that's the second coming of Christ, of course. But there are forms of postmillennialism. I think there are at least some postmillennialists historically who have contemplated some sort of catastrophic world event that would usher in the great golden age of peace, righteousness, and prosperity controlled by Christian perspectives and by Christians, right? So, in itself, it's simply the Greek version of millennial. Kiliasm is millennialism or premillennialism. Yeah.
Strong commentary for the book of Revelation.
Oh, sure. On a simple level, William Hendrickson's More Than Conquerors, it actually isn't part of Hendrickson's New Testament commentary series, but you have to buy it separately because he wrote it. It was like his master's thesis or something. Then, of course, on a more technical level, massive and probably irrefutable is Greg Beale's commentary of the Book of Revelation, recently published in, what's that series, the New International? NICNT or NIGNT? NICNT, right? It's the Book of Revelation by Greg Beale. I haven't read all of Greg Beale on the Book of Revelation, small parts of it really, but when you read his exposition of Revelation 21 to 10, which in its main features is identical to that of Hendrickson's, by the way, and mine, which I was glad to see. but it really looks like Beale has read everything ever written about the book, about Revelation 20 in his exposition. It's just utterly unbelievable, the scholarship. And he's got about 60 to 70 pages on Revelation 21 to 10. Unbelievable.
Volume.
Oh, really?
They've revised several.
Okay, all right. I did not know that. Mounts would have been a premillennialist too, right, I think. Yeah. So they replaced the premillennialist with an amillennialist? Just going right downhill, isn't it? Other questions? Let's see if there are any here. Bill Brown, it seems that Irenaeus' premill view led to Darby's premillennial view. Well, Bill, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. Maybe if you want to explain, I can do better. But I really think that early premillennialism was clearly what we call historic premillennialism and was not dispensational. And the reason for that is that the sine qua non of dispensationalism is the church-Israel distinction and the denial that the church is God's Israel. And Justin Martyr and I think Irenaeus and all the other early premillennialists clearly believed that Christians were God's true Israel, and so were not dispensationalists. Any other questions? Going, gone. All right. We'll take a 10-minute break, come back at about 20 minutes till.